Hi, welcome to Zeno's Commute, a podcast about philosophy adjacent things that I think are interesting. This week on episode 2, we're going to talk about René Descartes and I Think Therefore I Am. René Descartes was born in 1596 in France, which you might be able to guess from his name or from my terrible attempt at an accent. He was a Renaissance kind of guy. He, A, was around the right time period, but B, was pretty much into all of the things you imagine a Renaissance man to be into. He was a philosopher, he was a mathematician, he was a scientist, and he achieved quite a lot in all of those fields. We're obviously going to go into the philosophy field, but you might have heard of him from maths, where he created the Cartesian coordinate system. He was super into geometry, he was into algebra, he's into a lot of things. But we're going to talk specifically about philosophy. As a side note, anytime you hear the word Cartesian, it kind of means it comes from Descartes. For some reason, he kind of gets a whole little category that's his, Cartesian, which is a bit of a pain in the bum, and it honestly took me like 2 years to work out that Cartesian meant Descartes, because obviously Cartesian is just the last half of his name, which was an immense frustration to me as a student, and probably says more about me than the term Cartesian. But there we go. We're going to be talking specifically about I Think Therefore I Am, but first, it's pretty interesting how Descartes got into his kind of search for the truth, which leads him to I Think Therefore I Am. In around 1619, it's fairly specifically in 1619, when he was about 23, I guess. Jeez. He shut himself away in a room and had three dreams in which he believed a divine spirit or God revealed to him a new philosophy, one which led him to the pursuit of a fundamental truth, on which he believed he could base all of science. That fundamental truth turns out to be I Think Therefore I Am. So before we get into I Think Therefore I Am, it's interesting to note that the second of these three dreams may actually have been the first ever recorded instance of exploding head syndrome. According to Abidemi Ido Otaiku, and I'm honestly so sorry if I've mispronounced your name, because it's a really fascinating article. But yeah, so the second dream may have been exploding head syndrome. In the dream, he had a loud noise in his head before seeing a bright flash upon awakening, according to Otaiku. And he proposes that the second dream wasn't a dream, but exploding head syndrome, which would make it the earliest ever description of exploding head syndrome by nearly 200 years. So according to Wikipedia, exploding head syndrome is a condition where someone experiences an unreal noise are loud and short when you're falling asleep or waking up. They can be frightening, they're not painful, and you might also experience a flash of light. People don't really know why they happen, but the description fits. So the actual I Think Therefore I Am, this what was intended to be the main meat of this discussion. So I Think Therefore I Am, a lot of people end up calling it the Cogito, which I kind of hate because I think it's kind of a douchey way of saying it. The Cogito is a shortening of the Latin for I Think Therefore I Am, cogito ergo sum, or cogito ergo sum, or however you actually say it in Latin, so the original book actually never had it in Latin, it had it in French, which is said je pense donc je suis, and it later in kind of a later book. So A, it's not even in the original. B, it's just kind of exclusionary, saying the cogito is just a kind of shorthand for I Think Therefore I Am, and it's not that much shorter, and it's fine if you're writing in like, you know, a philosophical journal and you're only addressing other philosophers, all of whom know what the cogito is, but if you're addressing like students or you're talking to any normal human being, calling it the cogito is kind of wank. Sorry, I went off one a little bit, but it just annoyed me when I was like 18 and just learning, getting into philosophy for the first time. Anyway, So Descartes kind of looks at the world and goes, I need to find a fundamental truth on which I can build. And the way he decides to go about it is radical doubt. He is going to doubt everything until it can be absolutely proven. He does this by a fairly famous kind of construct. He says, what if an evil demon is kind of feeding me all these inputs, right? So that means I can't trust any of my senses, right? Because if I think I think I'm recording a podcast into a microphone, that microphone might actually, everything that I see might actually be like a complicated video screen being fed into my brain by the evil demon. If I think that, you know, I can smell food, that might be manipulation by the evil demon. So this kind of skepticism is actually a fairly potent thread in philosophy, I think it's fair to say. There are lots and lots of pieces of work that kind of discuss reality, what is or isn't real, what you can trust, what you can believe, and a lot of them call into doubt what you can see through your senses, because senses can be fooled. Obviously, in most cases, we don't normally think about them as being fooled by evil demons, but something like a hallucination where you see something that you absolutely believe is real, but it turns out it's not, it's that sort of thing, right? The world plays visual tricks on you sometimes. Sometimes you think you smell something that's not really there, so on and so forth. So there's kind of a history, both before and after Descartes, that revolves around this kind of skepticism. So Descartes looks at the world and goes, none of this, assuming an evil demon, is absolutely fundamentally provable. It's not beyond this kind of radical experiment in doubt. But what I can do is I can say, well, the evil demon is tricking me. But in thinking that, I've proved there is a me to trick. I think, and in thinking, I prove that I exist. Because there must be an I to do the thinking, is often how it gets put, which raises a lot of arguments, as you can imagine. As you can imagine, everything does in philosophy. It's a language construction, I think. Therefore, there must be an I to do the thinking. It's a linguistic trick. It's not necessarily proof in and of itself, unless you're really taking the concepts. It's like if I said, I see, therefore there must be an I that does the seeing, even if I doubt the existence of the things that I see, which actually is also kind of fair. So the linguistic argument isn't one I necessarily take hugely seriously. So the result is I think, therefore I am, because there must be a me, a mind that does the thinking. The evil demon is fooling. As a side note, Descartes actually isn't trying to say that you should doubt all of your senses all of the time. He's not, you know, Berkeley or any of the many other philosophers who actually don't believe their senses. But what Descartes is trying to do is say what is foundational, right? What can I build from? What is beyond all reasonable doubt, or unreasonable doubt in this case? And he thinks, I think, therefore I am, is that fundamental. He goes on to use it to logic God into existence, and then uses God to walk back his skepticism. He goes, God is good and trustworthy and a great guy, so he would never try and trick me through my senses, so I can believe them. Like, he wouldn't give them to me if they weren't for a purpose, which is a pretty nice view of the Christian God. It's kind of sweet, I guess. He says, through faith, I know that my senses are real, and through I think, therefore I am, I can prove that God is real. Honestly, after I think, therefore I am, it tends to fall down a bit, which is why you probably haven't heard of the other meditations, but I think, therefore I am has stuck around for good reason. It gives you a certain sense of certainty once you start really looking into Berkeley and all those other philosophers who really don't have faith in the world around them. You know, you kind of can't prove stuff that comes through you through your senses kind of objectively, because of things like hallucinations and dreams and all these things that seem real but aren't. It can screw you up if you think too hard about it, and I have. So assuming that none of that actually is real, not assuming an evil demon, but assuming your senses are fallible, that they are prone to screwing up, which is the entire basis of the kind of industry of optical illusions, then it's nice to think that, you know, I think therefore I am is absolutely certain. The problem is, I think therefore I am kind of gives you less leeway than you might imagine. I think therefore I am doesn't mean, you know, the you that you understand with your history and your kind of perception of yourself, because I think therefore I am doesn't guarantee you a past. All of your memories might have been, you know, secretly implanted in you by the evil demon to trick you into some behaviour or another. All that's guaranteed by I think therefore I am is kind of that moment of thought, the individual moment that you're living now. Everything else is completely, completely unprovable in Descartes' kind of construction of the world. It doesn't leave you much, or as much as potentially you were hoping it would leave you. It certainly doesn't give you any faith that other people exist. Other people are black boxes. They can walk up to you and they can say, I think, therefore I am. And you can say, I believe you. I trust that you too are a conscious human being. But you can't prove it in the way that you can prove that you exist, because you understand what you're experiencing. Does that make sense? I think that makes sense. So the consequences. This actually leads to a really fascinating area of philosophy, and we're not going to get into it all that hard, if that makes sense. We're not going to get super into it, but Descartes plants the seeds of something called mind-body dualism. He believes there's a difference between the mind, which is the I that does the thinking. It's your experience of yourself as like a thinking person. It's your kind of personality, I guess, your essence. It's not really a million miles away from the soul, which makes sense given Descartes' really, really heavily Christian motivations when he tries to prove God. But there's your mind, there's your body, which actually includes your brain. And Descartes thinks they're really, really heavily mixed together. Like he thinks that they are very, very close to each other, but he thinks they're absolutely separate things. Your mind controls your body, but it's not the same thing as your body, which has left a huge kind of mark on really the way that we think about ourselves and the world around us. I think the mind-body dualism thing, at least across Western culture, is fairly well ingrained, which is really interesting. Broadly, it's not something I particularly buy into, though I suspect in many ways I've acted according to it without really meaning to, because again, it's a super big thing across the Western world. I was reading a really interesting article by Abiba Behain, and again, I'm real sorry if I've pronounced your name wrong, on Ruminate, called René Descartes Was Wrong About Personhood. And what she says, again, also very sorry if I've got your pronouns wrong, is that, so according to Ubuntu philosophy, a newborn baby isn't a person, but rather that they acquire selfhood through kind of the social world. The distinction between me, the person, and other people is much blurrier. According to Abiba and a philosopher called John Mubiti in African Religions Philosophy, he said, I am because we are, and since we are, therefore I am. So a person partly comes from the community that they come from. She also talks about a Zulu phrase, which I'm not going to try and pronounce because honestly I think I'd do the worst job, but which means a person is a person through other persons. So I think therefore I am is very like individualist, right? It's I think therefore I am, and I am, you know, it draws you out of society. You don't need society to be a person. In fact, society is one of the things that falls away when you start this experiment in radical doubt. Instead, you get the I. And what kind of Abiba's talking about is sociality and the fact that, you know, man, oh God, it's a really annoying common expression, but man's a social animal. And a lot of our personalities and a lot of the way that we think comes from other people and comes from the way that we're raised and comes from the societies that we live in, and in ways that are really, really ingrained. So our understanding of fairness, or, you know, things that we'd stake our lives, our kind of the things that we really think are fundamental to us, actually a lot of them come from the surroundings that we grew up in. So I think therefore I am's great, but it kind of doesn't acknowledge the blurriness between, you know, you and the world around you, which I think is really interesting. But mind-body dualism isn't quite that, so I have got a little bit distracted. But mind-body dualism, I think, is kind of sketchy. So your mind, according to this, is different from your brain. Your brain is great, but it's not the same thing as the you that thinks and does all that stuff. But the thing is that you are so completely formed by the brain. Like, if you get a physical injury, so you get a traumatic brain injury and, like, maybe half of your frontal lobe is gone, the likelihood is it will drastically change your personality. And that's because your mind isn't some, you know, intangible thing separate from your brain, which is fundamentally different. Your brain, you are your brain, and you are your body. It's, you know, your fight or flight instinct, your all of those things that you do without your body asking your brain about, you know, where you touch something hot and you go, ooh, and then you move your hand away. All of those automatic responses, they're still you. They're not separate from you just because your body's doing them without asking your brain. They're one and the same thing, at least in my opinion, and many, many people would argue. Having said that, I think that's what's really interesting about robots in this context. So robots are all body, right? Robots don't have the experience of thought the same way that we would say that we do. I think therefore I am is not something a robot would say, unless we told it to, partly because, you know, they're a expression of code and algorithms and inputs, but also partly because as far as we know, robots don't have the kind of experience of thinking in the same way that we do. They don't have the what Descartes would describe as the mind aspect, right? The sense of self, the sense of autonomy, the sense of being a person thinking something through. They have algorithms and they have, you know, heuristics and all sorts of things, which means that, you know, you put inputs in and outputs come out, but the experience of the process is different. And that's kind of a not totally unconvincing argument for mind-body dualism, because, you know, our brains and our bodies are a collection of very similar things, right? We've got way more inputs in that we've got, you know, living in the world, and we've got probably a broader array of outputs, but the experience of coming to those outputs is fundamentally different. It's partly because we have, I would argue, free will, and God knows we'll definitely get into that another podcast, but also because we experience things and we think and we have a sense of self which feels, and all these things, and they come down to chemicals, but that doesn't make the experience of them less real or tangible or understandable or, you know, all of those things. It's just really fascinating, and the reason that people try and put distance between them is really fascinating. I think it does come down to this understanding almost of souls, where you want something that's intangible and special and kind of more than a collection of pathways and chemicals and electrical signals, because we want to be more than robots, right? We want that feeling that we're special, we experience things differently, we're more complex, we're capable of moral decisions, we're capable of all these things. And if you're religious, you know, you want to feel like you're going to go to heaven. I almost said hell for some reason, which I'm pretty sure is not what you want to feel if you're religious, but that some part of you is intangible, that your body may ultimately come to dust, but you and the part of you that was you, that was, you know, your collection of experiences and your emotional responses and what made you you, or what makes me Caitlin, and not some other Caitlin, will survive and it won't kind of crumble in the way that your body will. But I think part of what drives that is ego and is, you know, fear. And we want to explain why we think we're different. And I think that that's all perfectly valid. Like, I don't really have a problem with that. It's just that mind-body dualism can lead to some interestingly concerning shit. Like, if you think that you're completely separate from your body, there was a weird study done that said people who really bought into mind-body dualism took less good care of their health because they thought they were something other than their body. They had a less close relationship to it, so they took less care of it. Which I think sometimes you can see in, like, in what are they called, Silicon Roundabout, not Silicon Valley guys, right? The people that drink Huel and do all those stuff, keep trying to hack their bodies, kind of see their bodies as a way, like a vehicle for them, for their mind, a way of moving them around rather than, you know, something that is themselves. It's separate. And I think you can see that a lot in our understanding of our bodies and the way that we treat them. When we see them as separate from ourselves, if your body is you, if your body is wholly part of yourself, it is literally you rather than a separate thing, then you treat it better and you're kinder to it, and your experience of the world, I think, is different. So yeah, in short, TL, don't listen too long, don't listen, I guess. Although if you've gotten to this point, too late for that warning. I think therefore I am is an expression of radical doubt. It doesn't give you all that much certainty, but it does give you a little bit if you're looking for it. It essentially means that in this instant, in this moment, you know that you exist, you're a person, and you can build everything else on top of that. Absolute certainty, that bedrock foundation that you exist and you're a person. That's all for this week. I hope you enjoyed listening. Thank you to our theme song from the art punk band Xeno Says. Thank you for listening again. Please do all of the things that podcasters normally ask you to do, assuming that you liked it. If you don't like it, yeah, at me. You can find me on all the normal places on social media. If you want to argue about mind-body dualism and robots, I would love to hear from you. I love talking about robots. Let's do some recommended reading this week. If you've been reading Becky Chambers' series, I'm trying to remember, Wayfarers, it's called Wayfarers. If you've been reading Becky Chambers' Wayfarers series, the second book, I think, has some interesting things about mind-body dualism and as it relates to robots, which, yeah, I think it's really fascinating. And I think it's a really interesting book in relation to this specific topic. So if you want to read that and then yell at me on social media, that would also be cool. Okay, I'm going to actually say goodbye and actually mean it now. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week. I promise this gap was a bit ridiculous considering it's the first episode to the second episode, but nonetheless, life happens sometimes. Okay, I'm actually leaving now. God, it's like that person on the phone when you're like, oh, bye, they're like, bye, and then 90 minutes later, again, I didn't leave. Okay, goodbye, thank you for listening, talk to you next week.